Gold, frankincense, and myrrh, three expensive gifts from the wise men laid at the feet of baby Jesus. The offering of such gifts seems to be a warm and fitting closing scene to the first Christmas story, but of course the biblical telling of the Christmas story doesn't end there. After the gift opening, we see Mary, Joseph, and Jesus running for their lives, seeking to escape the rage and paranoia of a ruler named Herod, or as he preferred to be called, Herod the Great. Deeply embedded in the Christmas story and in the birth of Jesus in this world is the dark story of loss and tragedy, of tears and pain. It is a darkness that shrouds the Christmas story in Matthew. It is a darkness that shrouds the incarnation theologically. It is also a darkness that finds its way into our own lives. Christmas is a season when the tragedy of our losses comes back into our minds and into our thoughts. We remember the loss of parents, spouses, brothers, sisters, friends, and of daughters and sons. In this episode of the Authors on the Line podcast, we talk with two authors, John Piper, who will help us discover why pain and loss and tragedy is so deeply rooted in the theology of the incarnation of Christ, and why it is that we feel the sting of loss especially sharply around the Christmas season. But we begin historically with a look at Matthew 2:16, or as it has been traditionally called, the Massacre of the Innocents. The killing of all boys 2 years old and younger in the region of Bethlehem is deeply unsettling, but it's part of the historical record of the birth of Christ. Or is it? Did it actually happen historically, or was this massacre of the innocents actually invented by Christians? And if it's historically real, if it really happened, why is it that there's no other historical evidence that it did? Those are the questions I have for our first guest, Dr. Paul L. Meyer, a widely respected Christian historian. Until his retirement last year, the 82-year-old served as the Russell H. Siebert Professor of Ancient History at Western Michigan University. Dr. Meyer is the author of many fictional books and many non-fictional books, including In the Fullness of Time, A Historian Looks at Christmas, Easter, and the Early Church, as well as several books for children, including The Very First Christmas. From his office, I asked him to tell us more about the character we find embedded in the Christmas story, this man we know as Herod.
Well, Tony, you may be surprised to hear this, but believe it or not, if you're ever asked which is the one figure from the ancient world on whom we have more primary evidence from original sources than anyone else in the world, the answer is not Jesus or St. Paul or Caesar Augustus or Julius Caesar, none of those. Alexander the Great, no. It's Herod the Great, believe it or not. Why? Because Josephus gives us two whole book scrolls on the life of Herod the Great. And that's more primary material than anyone else. And I don't think Herod deserved it. He was a very remarkably successful politician, keeping the peace between Rome, which had conquered Judea ever since 63 BC, and he acted really simply as a Roman governor overseas. He was known as a client king, meaning very often when the Romans conquered a province, they didn't want to send a governor out. There was a local king doing a good enough job. And so, yes, he may be called king, but he was definitely deferent to Rome for his whole administration. He was in charge from, 40 BC, he was awarded the title king. He didn't actually take control of the land until, with Roman help, he drove some adversaries out of Jerusalem, and really from about 37 BC on, he's in charge until his death in 4 BC. He was remarkably successful in a lot of ways. He deserves the title Herod the Great if we talk about his accomplishments through much of his life. He was the one, of course, who rebuilt the great temple in Jerusalem. He was the one who single-handedly created a city at Caesarea, where there was no good port in the Holy Land. Here, he creates one by sinking some ship hulls and then using it as a base to build a great breakwater in an otherwise rectilinear sea coast. So, and he built Caesarea in 12 years, and he built other cities like that too. In Jerusalem, he facelifted the entire city. In addition to building a gorgeous palace for himself, he had a hippodrome, a stadium, and theaters and this kind of thing. He was kind of a Hellenistic monarch. And he also built seven great fortresses across the land, strong points of which he could defend his administration. One of them, of course, most famous, was Masada, down along the southwest corner of the Sea of the Dead Sea, I should say. Everything he touched diplomatically seemed to turn to gold. He kept peace both with Jerusalem and Rome, and so in that sense, he was very successful.
There's another side to Herod. Tell us a little bit about the paranoid side of Herod that begins to emerge later in his life.
Well, basically, he was responsible for many of the problems back home. His home was a can of worms, simply because he married 10 wives, and each of those produced princes for him, and each of those male princes was scheming to succeed as number one, and there can only be one number one. And so if there weren't two or three collateral plots taking place before they had orange juice in the morning, you know, something was wrong. Josephus gives us just a hideous tale of what was going on in the family, attempted poisonings, one brother against another. It so rattled Herod that he actually put to death three of his own sons on suspicion of treason. He put to death his favorite wife out of 10 of them. Mariamne was his favorite. She was a Hasmonean Maccabean princess. And he put her to death, and then he killed his mother-in-law. I should have said one of his many mothers-in-law. He invited the high priest down to Jericho for a swim. They played a very rough game of water polo, and they drowned him. He killed several uncles, a couple of cousins. Some have said he's a real family man in in that negative respect. As a matter of fact, Augustus himself, to whom Herod was always very deferent, said, "I would rather be Herod's pig than his son." It's a double pun. In Greek, it's suos and huios, a clever turn on words. And the other idea is that at least pigs weren't slaughtered for human consumption over there, and they had a better chance at a longer life. So it was a brilliant pun on the part of Augustus.
At one point in his life, late in his life, Herod plots to kill a stadium full of Jewish leaders. I mean, the plot has ultimately failed. It doesn't pan out. But explain that episode from his life and why he did this.
Well, Josephus says he had a very grisly thing to report about Herod in his last months. He was so paranoid that he, of course, did have some grasp of reality. For instance, he was worried that nobody would mourn his own death in the Holy Land. Of course, it shows how deadly accurate he was. They were preparing, again, you know, a general celebration. And nobody likes to die knowing that they're going to dance in your grave. And so he was going to give the people something to cry about. He's now it's in 4 B.C. He's down at his winter palace in Jericho. It's the only place in the Holy Land that doesn't snow or get cold in the winter. It's 1,200 feet below sea level. And here he's dying. He tries every remedy in the world to stop the gang of diseases that were creeping up on him. He went to the hot springs at Kalaroi at the northeastern corner of the Dead Sea. By the way, there's still springing hot water 2,000 years later. And that didn't cure him. And so now he goes back to his winter palace and he invites his sister Salome in. And he says, "I want you to arrest all the Jewish leaders in the land and imprison them in the hippodrome just below the palace here." And that hippodrome has been discovered archaeologically, by the way. And so she does, and then she says, "Brother, why am I doing this?" And Herod says, "Well, I know that when I die, the Jews are going to rejoice, so I'm going to give them something to cry about." And so he wants them all executed in that hippodrome so that there'll be thousands of households weeping at the time Herod the Great dies. So is that the kind of a sweet guy who could have killed the babies in Bethlehem? Yeah, I think so.
Speaking of Matthew 2, the Bible records a scene from Herod's paranoia late in his life. The wise men, of course, alert him to the birth of the new king in Bethlehem. They don't then return to him, and Herod eventually slaughters all the boys that are 2 years old and under in Bethlehem and in all the region. For all that Josephus wrote about Herod, he doesn't mention this. In fact, there's no extra-biblical evidence that this event even happened. How do you respond to that claim? Is the slaughter of the innocents historically reliable?
No, it's interesting. Josephus does not mention it, and therefore a lot of biblical critics will pounce on that aspect of a nativity account and say, therefore it didn't happen. Now, please understand, this is an argument from silence, and that's the weakest form of argumentation you can use. As we say in the profession, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And in this case, one or two things could have happened. Josephus may have heard about it and not used it, because you don't have hundreds of babies killed here. You have only about 12, as a matter of fact, 12 or 15. The infant mortality in the ancient world was so huge anyway that this is really not going to impress a reader too much, believe it or not. And I think if Josephus is choosing between the two stories about how Herod died right before his death, I think it would take the one where he's going to slaughter hundreds of Jewish leaders. Or he may not have heard about it, again, simply because, again, little Bethlehem doesn't amount to much. A little village of 1,500 or so, I did an actuarial study of Bethlehem at the time. You wouldn't have more than about two dozen babies 2 years old and under, half of them the wrong sex. And so this is not a big deal, and I think that's why Josephus either never heard about it or didn't feel it important enough to record. So this does not militate against Matthew's version by any means. In fact, I was arguing once years ago on the infant massacre with a professor in Wagner College in New York who claimed that this is all fiction, that surely a massacre of hundreds of Jewish boy babies would have come to the attention. Well, I agree, it would have if there had been hundreds. It couldn't possibly be the case. And all the coasts thereof, well, look, Jerusalem's 5 miles away, right? So, therefore, this would include Jerusalem as well if we're going to take literally all the coasts thereof. We're talking about Bethlehem and probably half mile around when we're talking about the surroundings of Bethlehem.
As a historian, is there any doubt in your mind about the historicity of the slaughter of the innocents?
I see not one iota of evidence that it could not have happened. And therefore, again, there's no reason to doubt the account as far as I'm concerned. To be sure, Luke hasn't heard about it. Remember, Matthew and Luke don't copy from one another when it comes to the nativity. And that's good, because this way they can hit it from different angles. I think it really happened. And let's remember again that the first martyr of Christianity was not Stephen, it was Jesus, but not even Jesus. For my money, the first martyr in the Christian church was the first baby that was killed in Bethlehem, and we always overlook that.
That was author and historian Dr. Paul L. Meyer. What if, in fact, the first little boy that was killed in Bethlehem, the first Christian martyr, what if he was the son of the very man who gave Mary and Joseph permission to use his stable? Such a decision would have put his family directly in harm's way when Herod's killing squad worked out from the places Jesus was known to have been. This scenario is not far-fetched, and it's a scenario for a fictional poem written by John Piper titled The Innkeeper. In light of the historicity of the slaughter of the innocents, the event is even more unsettling because it was a real tragedy that touched real families and forever changed the lives of mothers and fathers in Bethlehem. And Pastor John helps us to see and to feel the weight of this tragedy. And what this again means is that embedded in the Christmas story is a story of loss and tragedy. And for us today, this is a fitting reminder, because for all of our emphasis on gift buying and gift giving and celebrations and gathering with loved ones, for many families, Christmas is an annual reminder of losses, the loss of parents, spouses, brothers, sisters, friends, and of daughters and sons. From his office in Minneapolis, I asked Dr. Piper why the sting of personal loss is felt especially at Christmas time.
My guess is it's multiple levels of things. One is the sheer sweetness and sensitivity of precious celebrative moments like anniversaries, birthdays, Christmas, Thanksgiving, where the nature of the event simply sensitizes us to everything. Everybody becomes more precious at moments when we are traditionally drawn together as families, or we're focused on some deeply meaningful thing like a birth or the birth of Jesus or the time we got married. And as we're calling these deep experiences of life to mind, we are generally sensitized and deepened and made, I think, vulnerable to deeper emotions. Christmas, I think, is especially intense because of the depth and magnitude of what we're about here. I was just thinking about it this morning, about God has come into the world, and he's come into the world to unite himself to a frail human nature precisely so that he can die. So in a sense, you might say the subterranean emotional framework or foundation for experiences of loss is being laid by the Father's preparing to endure a loss. The Father did not spare his own Son, but gave him up for us all. How will he not with him freely give us all things? So God is preparing with this little baby that he'll grow up and be beaten and be rejected and die so that we might be saved. So here's the Father of the universe preparing to endure the loss of a son in Christmas time. That's what it's about. Hebrews 2:14, that we, because we children share in human nature, he likewise partook of the same nature so that by death, through death, he might deliver us from him who has the power of death. So we know that he took on human nature at Christmas so that he could die, which means so that the Father could lose him. So it doesn't surprise me at all that every one of us who's endured any kind of loss would have something deep rumbling up within us because of Christmas time.
You connect the themes of Christmas and loss in your book, The Innkeeper. Explain the value of your poem for families who are reminded at Christmas time of their losses.
Yeah. The poem pictures Jesus returning to the inn where he was born 30 years later to meet the man who gave room to his parents, and then within about 2 years, that man loses both of his children and his wife to Herod's murder squad as they're trying to kill all the babies who might have been Jesus. And Jesus knows that this man paid the price of losing everybody in his family in order to house the birth of the Messiah. And he's going back to meet the man, find him, and see how he's doing and say something hopeful to him. So the structure of the poem is to address a dad who lost two sons, a wife, and he did it precisely in the service of Jesus. And I dedicated the book to Roland Erickson. It's called To Roland and All Who've Ever Lost a Child. And Roland was one of the grand old men at our church. And when I wrote this years ago, he was alive. He's not anymore. And he lost a 25-year-old son on the operating table owing to a human error. And I've just felt a deep empathy for people who have lost children because of nothing that they did wrong. You know, this is nothing. They didn't do anything wrong. They did right. And children were snatched out of their lives where they're little, like this innkeeper. I'm just making this up, but I can imagine easily that it might have happened this way. It's an imaginative reconstruction of the slaughter of the innocents. And where would they go first, these soldiers, except to ask around and say, now where was he born? Where was he born? And they say, well, he might have been born down at that inn down there. We heard some rumor about that. So they go down there and they start the killing there with that poor innkeeper's sons.
The Christmas story is inseparable from the Golgotha story and the Easter story. And you tie together the work of Christ at the end of your poem. How does the full life and work of Christ shed light on the tragedy of loss and the infant massacre in Matthew 2 that touches the life of the innkeeper? And how does the gospel shed light on the pain and loss that we experience so sharply around the Christmas season?
the last thing Jesus does as he's crying, and the innkeeper can't quite understand why this 30-year-old man is crying, and then he says, I'm the boy that was born here 30 years ago, or 33 years ago, we don't know exactly how much. I'm the boy who was born here, and I have just come to tell you that I'm going to go in 2 weeks up to that city, just a few miles from here, the Jerusalem, and I'm going to die there, and I'm going to come back to life, and when I do, I'm going to bring back to life your wife and your children with me, so that even though you may not have a satisfactory answer in this life for why those children were snatched away from you when they were, I want to make sure that underneath this perplexity and this pain, you have a rock-solid hope that God wasn't evil, he wasn't against you, and that he's going to bring back, because of Jesus and his death and his resurrection, the very ones that you lost in serving him. Now, I think that's what we can say about all of our losses. Any losses that we endure in the pathway of serving Jesus, whether they're explicitly connected with knowing him by way of persecution or just an incidental evil that comes into our lives while we're on the path of obedience, every one of those losses will be repaid to us a thousandfold in the resurrection. And that's what Jesus died and rose again to bring about.
Dr. Piper, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. I wish you and everybody who listens to this a very joyful, deep, blessed Merry Christmas, even if it's been through loss.
That was John Piper from his office in Minneapolis. Special thanks to him and to Dr. Paul Meyer for joining us for this episode of the Authors on the Line podcast. You can download John Piper's book, The Innkeeper, for free from the Desiring God website by typing in the following URL, dsr.gd/The Innkeeper, all in lowercase letters and with no spaces. Again, that's dsr.gd/The Innkeeper. This free podcast is supported, produced, and distributed by Desiring God in Minneapolis. You can subscribe and find a full archive of episodes by searching for Authors on the Line in the iTunes Store, or watch for new episodes online at desiringgod.org/blog. I'm your host, Tony Ranke. Thanks for listening.